And welcome to everybody here in Parramatta. And we're joining you from the sacred land of the Parramatical people of the Darug Nation, upon whose land we live and walk and eat and drink coffee and practice our spiritual path. So I'm just hesitating a minute because some more people might be showing up here, but maybe we can just get started with the chanting. All right, let us can we turn the lights down? Is that a thing? Can we do that?
We don't have a lamp.
Oh, we don't have our lamp, right. Yeah. Normally we have a lamp, that's right.
So if you turn them off, it's just all off, isn't it?
Well, we're still daylight. We've still got some daylight outside. We can maybe last until the meditation without. What do you reckon?
But then can they see you, or are you just you're kind of, are you there?
I'm high lit by, I've got a halo. I'm just a shadow with a halo, which that's like represents my personal self-image. in an uncomfortably revealing way.
I've got to follow your lips for the chant.
Got to follow the lips for the chant. Yeah, this is the test. This is the test. Let's just try it for a minute, and we'll see. Like when it gets too dark, we can just turn the lights back on, right? But it is a bit nice, at least for the beginning. All right. So let us begin with some chanting in homage of the triple chant. Thank you so much to anybody who's sharing that white noise with us. That's really appreciated. But we have that offering now. So Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Itipiso bhagava arahaṃ sammasambuddho vijjacarana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhamma sarathi Sattha deva manusanam buddho bhagavati svakato bhagavata dhammo sandirtiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko Pachatam vedita bo vinyuhiti Supatipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho
Ujjupatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Nyayapatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Samichipatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yadidam Chattari Purisa Yugani Atta Purisa Pungala Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ahuneyo Pahuneyo Dakirneyo Anjali Karyaniyo Anuntaram Punyaketam Lokasati. Okay, very good. All right. So we are about to, we'll do some guided meditation in just a minute. But before we do that, I just want to give an update about the talks and the event schedule and so on. Just to make sure that we're all on the same page here. So this place we're in now, the Temple of Humanity, is the lease is expiring, and they're actually moving out of this place tomorrow. So this is different than what we thought. We thought that we had one more week here, and so on the calendar we have one more week for this Friday. So that's a mistake, and I'll correct that as soon as I get the chance. We just learned that just as we were setting up today. So I apologize to everybody for that. But that means that this is going to be the last Friday night talk for this year, okay? So I do apologize, but that was just an unexpected one of those things. So this venue, which was always a temporary venue for us, they're losing their lease, and so they don't have a new place or anything. So that's that for now. Now, we have, I believe, sorted out the schedule and the venues for next year. Well, not quite sorted out, but I think we have a solution, and hopefully that'll be sorted out in the next few days. So one of the things that I've always wanted to do is I wanted to keep doing talks in Parramatta, and I want to keep this Friday night talk going, and especially the Friday night hybrid talk going. But we had a lot of difficulties because we couldn't find a venue that's available on a Friday night in Parramatta. And so it wasn't until I was able to realize that these were two separate things. One is giving a talk on Friday nights. The other one is giving a talk in Parramatta. And they don't have to be together. So what we're going to do, and this is not confirmed yet, but it seems likely, we're going to swap the days with Crow's Nest. So we're going to be doing Crow's Nest on the Friday night. We're already doing Wednesdays at the Crow's Nest. We're going to be doing Friday nights at Crow's Nest, and the Crow's Nest Centre has already said that that's okay. And we're going to be doing a weeknight here in Parramatta at, and here I hesitate, at 5.
5 p.m.
No. I literally said that to the staff today. I literally said that. How do we pronounce the name? Is it P-Hive or Five?
Oh, right.
And they said, it's Five. But I spoke to staff the other day, and they said, I don't know. Well, I say, is it P-Hive or Five? Anyway, so they said, it's Five. I said, that's very confusing because people are going to say it's what, 5 p.m.? And that's a little... So, yeah, so that's what happened. Anyway, so there's the local Parramatta Library / Community Hub. It's a new venue, very nice venue, and really well done. I've been actually going down there the last few days and checking it out and checking out the rooms and so on. It's a really nice vibe. It's very community friendly. It's very safe. It's very like accessible, like wheelchair friendly. Public transport is great. There's a car park adjacent to it, so you don't have to worry about parking. All of that stuff is really good. So I'm really happy that we're able to be there. So the Five, it's named Five because it's on 5 Parramatta Square, but it's P-Hive because it's a, I always thought it was like a pun on beehive. Anyway, whatever. So someone's a little bit too clever in the marketing department, if you ask my opinion. So we'll probably be doing talks there on a weekday starting from next year. And I really hope that we can make that a long-term venue, because we've been a little bit unstable this last year or so. And I'm really hoping that we can be there and sort of grow with that community, because they have like a number of different rooms. So if you have more people, we can use a different room and that kind of thing. They also have, you know, a lot of really good facilities and a good kind of vibe there. So, right. So the Peahive, the five closes at 8. So what we're going to do, I think, is we're going to book a space from 6 till 8, and it will be starting time will be 6:30. So we can meet at 6 and have a cup of tea and a chat. All right. So anybody wants to come along, talk about meditation, say hello, blah blah blah. Then we meet at 6, and the actual meditation so on starts at 6:30. Yeah. We have to be out by 8. So that's what I'm kind of thinking. There's a nice space with a terrace I'm hoping to get. So we'll just have to see. One detail is that the Metta Center is running. There's very few meditation groups in the east of Sydney generally, but Metta Center obviously has been running some sessions, and they do a session at the University of Western Sydney, which is like a couple of, you know, just next door almost, and they've been doing that on the Wednesday evenings. So we would obviously like to avoid clashing with them if possible. But that depends on availability of the space. So we will probably try to not do it on Wednesday. We'll try to do it on a Tuesday. That's what we're going to be aiming for. All right. And like I said, and I've mentioned this a few times over the last couple of months. And as most of you know, that we really have been looking for places for a while. I've spent hours literally just walking around the streets of Parramatta, poking my nose into different places and saying, I wonder, that was interesting. Maybe we can something there. And so, yeah, it has been a bit of a trial. So I'm really happy that we can get this solution. And I know that when you make a change like this, that it's never going to suit everybody. I'm sorry about that. But I'm hoping that it will be for the growth of the community for the long term. Okay, now my plan, and again, this is it's not 100% set in stone, but the plan will be that starting around mid-January next year, we will begin back again on the Fridays in Crow's Nest, and the Crow's Nest event will be the hybrid event. So all of the folks online, you won't notice any difference. Just the background will be not quite as nice as this one. So you won't have fancy coloured lights. We can maybe get some fancy coloured lights, but so it'll be at the Crow's Nest venue. So for the folks joining online, there won't be any change. We'll just be doing it from a different venue. For the folks coming in Sydney, Friday night in Crow's Nest, and it'll be probably Tuesday night here in Parramatta, okay? And what I hope to do is to kick off next year by doing a four-week Introduction to Buddhist Meditation course. All right, so we can put this together, and we'll run it concurrently both in Crow's Nest and Parramatta. And so the first 4 weeks will be an introduction to Buddhist meditation, and so that will be hopefully a way of onboarding some new people, as well as affirming our meditation practice and supporting our New Year's resolution that we're all going to do our regular meditation practice next year. So that will be, that's what I'm thinking as a way of beginning that next January. It'll be mid-January probably. We'll get the dates to you soon. So keep an eye on the Lokanta website, and we'll be posting the dates there as soon as we can confirm them. Okay? Okay, very good. So please do let us know if anybody has any feedback or anything like that, any questions. But that's going to be the plan. The Friday night session will still be online, okay? So the Friday night session is online. This is an answer to Mike. And so for online people, nothing will change. Same link, same time, everything's the same. The Wednesday night Parramatta session or Tuesday night will be in person only. We'll only do one hybrid. So the Parramatta session will be only in person, as is the current Crow's Nest one that's only in person. And just so you know, the Meta Center event is a hybrid event. So that's on the Wednesday. So if you feel the need for a hybrid event on a Wednesday, it's already on offer. Okay. Any questions on that? No? Okay, fine. Let's move ahead to the meditation. Okay, Meta Center also does most Mondays, right? I think they're doing the Mondays in Bankstown and the Wednesdays in Parramatta, yeah. Look, here's my take on it. My take on it is, there's 5 million people in Sydney and they're all suffering and they and so I don't think personally that having a few small meditation groups on the same night, I don't think we should be thinking of that as like competing or anything like that. There's actually plenty of dukkha to be eased. So, you know, but having said which, you know, I do think it's better if we can avoid clashing if, you know, it is literally just a few doors away. So, yeah, if we can avoid clashing, it would be better. All right. So let me say just a few words about meditation, then we can do guided meditation together. So this is going to be our last talk for this year. And as you, those of you who have been here before would know that in every session that I've been doing, and I've been doing this for 20-something years now, every session we always begin with a little bit of instruction on meditation and a little bit of guided meditation. And the path of Dhamma is very rich and very broad, and there are many things that that we can bring within the scope and the perspective of having a understanding through the eyes of the Dhamma. But of all the things that Buddhism teaches and all the things that the Buddha taught, then meditation has this very central place. And we know that the defining image of Buddhism is a man sitting in meditation, sitting peacefully in meditation. And that's consciously or unconsciously, I think, is one of the things that really inspires us and represents the essence of Buddhism. Like, how do we, like, the Buddha, to my mind, represents a possibility. He represents the possibility that we can transcend suffering, that we can find peace, and we can do it here in this human realm. To me, it's very important that the Buddha is a human being. He's not a god, not a deity, nothing like that. He's just a person who practiced and let go of suffering, let go of those things that are creating suffering inside himself. And as a result of doing that, was able to embody that pure and profound peace and stillness. And it's, I think, one of the remarkable features of human culture that Buddhism has survived for 2,500 years and flourished for all of that time, simply because a man sat down and let go and found peace. That's the essence of Buddhism. You think about it, it's kind of wild. Like, you think about, like, say, more conventional religion like Christianity or something like that. God is like delivering the Ten Commandments on a mountaintop in stone tablets. I mean, that's pretty dramatic stuff, okay? Right? This is like, but is Buddha just, oh yeah, so the man was sitting quietly for a while and then thought, oh yeah, now I see things clearly. And that's the essence of Buddhism. And that's what is still inspiring us all of these years later. So for us as practitioners who are inspired by this, there is something to be, is always like an emulation or an embodiment of those teachings that the Buddha taught. And one thing which the Buddha emphasized right from the beginning and constantly through his teachings, this is the path that I practiced and it's the path that you too can practice. And he said, I would not be teaching this and I would not be sharing it if I did not think that you could realize this teaching as well. That is the essence of the Buddha's path. So all of the other things that we can talk about, you know, during the Rains retreat, we did a whole series on dependent origination and we got kind of quite fancy and quite complicated and stuff. Because Because I like that stuff. I think it's fun and maybe it's useful for people. I don't know. But it's really interesting. There's so many interesting things in Buddhist philosophy. But at the end of the day, it's actually very, very simple. If we can sit and let go, we can be happy. Imagine that. Imagine being able to be happy with nothing. Not because you get what you want, not because you can control people around you, not because you can achieve anything, just because you are genuinely and truly happy inside yourself. It's an astonishing insight. And it's not just something that lives in scriptures or in traditions, but it's something which is experienced by people all the time. And there are people all over the world. And since I've been a monk, I've traveled to many countries and I've taught and practiced meditation in many countries with many people. And you realize that that experience of letting go can be found anywhere. It's not based on anything other than being human and having some wisdom and being able to put that effort into practice. So let's do some meditation for today. So sitting quietly. And letting the mind settle down inside your body. Now, as you feel your body become relaxed, your mind become balanced, notice the gentle feeling of the breath as it comes in and the breath as it goes out. Mindfully breathing in. Mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in. Mindfully breathing out. Don't worry too much about your mind going off. Just be aware of it. Oh, okay, my mind's thinking again. Be aware of it, let it go, come back. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Notice how your breath is becoming a little bit softer, a little bit smoother. Even if your mind isn't completely still, you can feel your body becoming still. And that carries within it too a certain ease in the mind, a lack of disturbance. Now coming near to the end of the meditation, I want you to briefly check back over your meditation and see how your mind has changed in the last 20 minutes or so. Can you recall what your mind was like when you first began the meditation? Now, the clarity with which you can recall that tells you something about your mindfulness. If your mindfulness is strong, you'll be able to recollect that very clearly. If your mindfulness is a bit wobbly, then you'll be a bit unclear about that. So this is giving us the feedback to be able to let us know where we need to improve. And then during the course of the meditation, how did things change? How did your breath change? What did your breath feel like? How did that feeling change during the course of the meditation? And finally, look at how your mind is like now. Remind yourself that whatever peace that you have gained through the meditation, that is your peace. It's something that's arisen from your practice, from your wisdom, from your mindfulness. And that is the tangible manifestation of the benefits of meditation. And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Okay, great. Let's have a bit of a break for 5 minutes. You can stretch your legs, and then we'll come back for some Dhamma talk. So Mike points out Metta Center also does most Mondays. And as Adrian's pointed out just here, that the Metta Center does Mondays and Wednesdays. The Santi nuns do Thursdays, and we've traditionally done Fridays. So that sort of leaves Tuesday as being the ideal day for our talk. So it looks like we'll probably aim for Tuesday. Tuesday seems like the best day anyway. Thursday's a bit too close to the Friday talk because some people go to both. So Mike has commented, and 5M in New Zealand. I assume that that's a group in New Zealand doing some talks or something. If you've got any more information on that, Mike, you could pop that in there. I'm sure people would be interested. And just coming back briefly to Scott's comment here, and I want to thank you. Thanks, Scott, for saying this, and just to sort of bring it up and make sure that everybody knows. So Scott says, I'm not going to be turning on my camera tonight. I recently saw the richest being and his PR proliferating, promoting and rejoicing over the use of LLMs, that is large language models, or aka AI, aka ENMDD. It's a technical term, ENMDD. You know that one?
No.
ENMDD? You haven't heard that one? Oh, evil God. Nazi machine of delusion and death.
Oh, I think I've heard you say it. You must have said it before.
So the evil Nazi machines of delusion and death. Not that I have an opinion about it or anything, but for the purpose of just promoting, rejoicing the use of LLMs for the purpose of destroying human beings, yeah. I know that it seems difficult to comprehend, but I cannot emphasize enough that the fundamental purpose of AI is to eliminate humanity, and it always has been, back to the 1950s. They target anyone, they said, and said how easy it is just to capture their likenesses without their permission, and the machine will do all their rest. So Scott's not wanting to share his likeness because he doesn't want AI to be capturing his image and using it against his will. And I 100% respect that, Scott. And I think that's a really sensible choice. For myself, I'm not really sure. Yeah, it's probably a bit late. But anyway, look, I just want to put that out there and just say for anybody, if you feel the same, like normally I ask people to put their cameras on because for me, I like it's nice to be able to see people when you're giving the talk. But if you'd rather not, then I think that that's very, very kind of reasonable and sensible thing to do, to be honest. As far as I know, Jitsi is not using AI. And if they were, then we would choose a different service. But you never know. Like, like pretty much all the companies have some kind of AI function somewhere. Mm-hmm. But as far as I know, they're not capturing your data. If somebody has any other information, then please let us know. But as far as I know, that's the case. For people who are not familiar with Jitsi and how they work, Jitsi, this is the it's basically like Zoom, and it's what we're using for the video sharing. They've been really good as far as I'm concerned. We're basically running on the same open URL. It's just a publicly posted URL on the web for years without any problems. I don't know. Everyone seems to have all these security things and passwords and meeting numbers and everything. We just posted a URL and it works okay. Their business model is that they provide communications for companies. And as part of providing those communications for companies, they develop the infrastructure for this video sharing. And then they just make that available for public use. So it's really just kind of a side thing on their main business, which is actually helping companies to, whatever, figure out their internal communications. So that's why they're able to do it for free. And I don't think that they're particular, because their business model is not dependent on data, so I don't think they're particularly motivated to scrape everybody's data for that. So as far as I know, that's not being done on Jitsi, but it certainly is a valid concern, yeah. 5 million people. Oh, Mike says no. So the 5M was not a talk called 5M in New Zealand. It was 5 million people in New Zealand who could be here to watch the talk. That's excellent, Mike. having said about how good Jitsi has been, I do feel that that might stress their infrastructure. Nonetheless, worth giving it a go. So, Mike, if you could just organise that, then we'll see how that copes. Okay, great. Yeah. All right, so fine. Okay, so we're going to do... Okay. Right, okay. Oh, okay, good question there from Marianne. Okay, great. And so just on that question of the AIs and so on, there's some discussion on the chat between Scott and Gillian, and just to clarify that Scott was talking about destroying people psychologically, and as many of you probably are aware, that AI has in fact driven quite a number of people to suicide, and the response of the AI companies is that... asking the AI about suicide is against the terms of service. So it's the user's fault to be asking it about suicide. And the fact that they're dead is not their company's problem. These are the kinds of people that we're dealing with. So don't trust AIs. Anyway, moving along. On to better things. Thank you, Marianne. That is a very nice question. And I'm going to take your question as a topic for this evening's little talk. Marianne says, from France, all the way from France. How's it going in France, Marianne? Had any revolutions lately? All croissants. I don't know. Sorry, Marianne?
I'm very shy to speak. In front of a lot of people, I would like to answer your questions, but I don't really know how, and I think they're rhetorical questions, but I'm not sure.
Good to see you. Anyway, they'll usually shut off in a minute anyway. Okay. Yeah, they usually just go for it. I don't know what it is, but it usually goes for a minute and then it'll be quiet. Sorry, everyone, there's just some noise outside. We'll just wait for a minute. Oh, they're doing the blowing. Okay, very good. So I know somebody was just decided that this was a good time to do the leaf blowing outside with a leaf blowing machine. Hand up anybody who thinks that those leaf blowing machines should be banned. Yes, what's wrong with brooms? Anyway, moving along. Fine, so back to Marianne's question. Dear Bhante, you said that in a retreat that metta meditation, even when it is developed, is not enough to be kind in relationships with others. We need to consciously apply an effort to be kind when interacting with people and animals and plants. And Marianne said she added the animals and plants in there. Why is it not automatic if, since there is no self? I thought that each factor of the path was feeding each other. Can you explain that, please? Thanks for your teachings. Marianne, I would be delighted to explain that. So the basic idea here is that you can't fix problems with your behavior with your meditation. And while there's many different ways we can think about this, if we look at it, one of the ways that I understand this through like that. There's a phrase that was used by Ken Wilber, the developmental psychologist or integrative psychologist. He talks about different aspects of the mind being relatively independent. And I think that's quite a useful term. Things can be relatively independent. So that means they're not totally connected, nor are they totally separate. And it's quite common that there might be like different tracks or different pathways in the mind that can be developed to different degrees by people. Not only just common, I think it's normal, it's universal, that we can develop different faculties to different degrees. And those things are somewhat separate and somewhat independent. And this is why, very common, that you can often find people who maybe seem very wise or very developed in one way, but have massive blind spots in another way. Happens all the time, and it's probably happening to all of us. So one of the things that Ken Wilber pointed out, which I think was an interesting, a useful insight, he said that when we talk about spirituality and spiritual development and spiritual growth, we can easily become confused because we mean two quite different things by that, okay? So the first thing that we mean when we talk about spiritual growth is growth in those things that we consider to be spiritual, most obviously in meditation. So we have meditation, it's a spiritual practice. I can do that practice, and that practice is somewhat independent of everything that's happening in my life. Whatever happens to me in my day, I can go and I sit meditation, and it is how it is. And if we can develop that meditation, especially, this is true especially on retreats, and this is one reason why, if you've listened to my teachings over the years, I don't emphasize retreats too much. I think retreats are good, encourage people to go on them. But retreats are very separated from your life. I mean, that's kind of the whole point. And in and of itself, unless you're able to integrate that, then what happens on a retreat is not necessarily indicative of what else is going on in your life. So you can be somebody who does retreats regularly, maybe has great meditation on the retreats or something like that, but not necessarily that you're going to be growing in other areas of your life. So that's one thing that we can call spiritual development, is growth in those things that are spiritual. That's one aspect. And the other aspect is what we call spiritual development is the integration of all the different aspects of who we are. Right? So all the different aspects of our emotions, our cognition, our feelings, our memories, our behaviors, and so on, all acting in a way that is whole and balanced. And that's another thing that we can call spiritual. But it's not necessarily a particular spiritual practice. Might not have anything to do with a spiritual practice, but we have a sense of wholeness and contentment with ourselves. So once we realize that, then we can realize that this is one of the problems with engaging in a spiritual practice. And it can result in what we sometimes call spiritual bypassing. So spiritual bypassing is essentially when you maybe develop a particular spiritual practice and then use that as a way of almost like neglecting or even explaining away those other things. Okay, I'm going to come back to that a little bit more. So that's like one model of thinking about it that I sort of picked up from reading Ken Wilber many years ago. So to look at the same thing from a Buddhist perspective. All right, so in a Buddhist perspective, when we talk about the development of the path, we talk about sila, samadhi, panya. Sila is ethics or behavior, conduct. Second one is samadhi, is development of meditation. And the last one is wisdom. All right, now these three have an integrated relationship. They all work together. The better your ethical conduct is, the better your samadhi is, the better your wisdom is, but also the better your wisdom is, then the better your ethical conduct is. They all work together. But they can also be separated to some degree, okay? So you can see that same thing can apply. Somebody, for example, might be highly, very intelligent, even very wise in some ways, but not actually have good ethical conduct. Or somebody might be able to do very good meditation, right? And maybe be able to sit meditation very still and be able to be very peaceful for many times. But then if you ask them questions or ask them about their practice, they don't have any wisdom. They don't have any understanding. So these things can happen. And it's not that there's anything wrong with that particular thing, right? Their development of ethics or samadhi or wisdom itself is good. But it's the lack of integration of those three things which is the problem, right? The integration is a separate thing. Now, generally speaking, in Buddhism, it goes sila, samadhi, panya. So it's your behavior first. Sila is your actions of body and speech, all right? Now, those actions of body and speech are informed by and at least partially directed by your intention, right? Sila is concerned with intentional action, valueless or just automatic action. It's things that you do that have a moral import, have a value component to them. But what they are about intrinsically is those actions. How do you talk? What do you do? So this is why when we take the precepts, we say, I'm not going to kill, I'm not going to steal, I'm not going to commit sexual misconduct, I'm not going to lie, and I'm not going to take alcohol and drugs. So these are behaviors. And we can take on a vow for ourselves that we want to stop doing these conducts. Now, those conducts obviously have to do with our mental state. So the killing comes from the desire to harm, comes from anger, right? But you can't make a vow to have no anger, unfortunately. Well, you can, but it's not going to work. I mean, if it does, good on you, but usually it's not really going to work. Right? You can make a vow. The Buddha wanted us to do things that we can do, not to try to do things that we can't do. What we can do is stop killing and harming any living being. That's already a big deal, right? Now, maybe there's a cockroach in your house and you're like, okay, I'm going to squash this cockroach and kill it. And then you're like, yeah, death to all cockroaches. And then you're like, hang on, no, I'm keeping my precept, okay? In my mind, I really want to kill this cockroach, but I'm not going to do it, okay? So I'm going to brush the cockroach, take the cockroach outside, put him outside, fine, okay? managed to keep my precepts on that one. So, this is why we focus first of all on your behaviors. It's a bit like, I mean, it's similar like to like developmentally, like when you're, you know, if you're bringing up a kid, the first thing you have to do with your kid is like get them to stop misbehaving, you know, and, you know, later on they'll sort of gradually learn to understand and so on why they're supposed to do this. But initially it's just like, do not stick your tongue in the electricity socket, okay? Just stop them from doing that for starters. And we'll explain the reasons why later on, you know. So the things, first, the foundations of Buddhist conduct is that ethical conduct. Now, if your ethics and if your precepts are not good, can you still begin meditation? Sure you can. Can you even progress in meditation? Sure you can. But there's a level of disintegration there. If you're doing metta meditation and having love for all sentient beings and so on and so forth, but you're still at your actions are primary, you're still acting in a way that is cruel or that is harmful or that is malicious, then there's a lack of integration between those things. And this is where we come back to Marianne's question. So how does that play out? How does that work? Well, if you develop let's just take this one example. Okay, let's just say I'm having an argument or a fight or conflict with somebody. Fine, happens, and we're having blah blah blah, saying cruel and nasty words to each other. Maybe it's about, actually, I was just with my friend Meng. We just did an event in the States, and we did the dispute in Kosambi. So the quarrel in Kosambi was a famous conflict in the Sangha. Originally, it was about the water that was left in a water dipper in the bathroom.
Yeah.
So one of the monks left water in the water dipper, and the other monk said, "You can't do that. It's against the Vinaya." He said, "No, it's not." He said, "Yes, it is." And so the whole community split, and everyone was arguing with each other. Okay. Why? It's reason it's an issue is because if you're in tropical countries, you leave the water dipper out, then the mosquito larvae will be born in there. And then you have to figure out what you're going to do, right? Because you can't just throw it out or something like that. So according to the Vinaya, you're supposed to, like, find a pond or a lake or something like that and then take the water to it and then dispose of the water there without killing the mosquito larvae. Just by the way, I'll just tell you a story. This happened to me when I was on retreat once in Malaysia. So I was in Ipoh. I spent a year in Ipoh, and I was staying in this cave, the Sukawana Cave in Bircham. And for the retreat, we built a kuti inside the mountain. So this mountain had like a whole kind of thing, and we'd like made a tunnel through. There was like a sort of a way through the mountain that was all like fallen rocks and dirt and stuff like that. And we sort of made our way through. And small use of explosives. I mean, it was. They did tell me later that we could have been hung for it. But apart from that, they have this emergency law still in effect in Malaysia. So, whatever. Okay, this is. But anyway, so we got through to the mountain, and then inside, like enclosed inside the mountain, there is this empty space, an open space, and so we built a kuti in there. And so I went and spent the rain retreat, so 3 months of the rain retreat spent in that kuti, not really coming out or talking to anyone. And the community there, we talked about it and we established this stuff and everything. So I was going to just do my meditation. So it was fantastic. So it was a really good, nice little retreat. So I had a drinking water, a tank there, and I had that problem. I had a water scoop, which I left some water in, and then I got some mosquito larvae in it. And I was like, oh, what a hassle, bloody mosquito larvae. And then I was like, what am I going to do? I could take it down to, like, there was a creek nearby. I thought I was just take it down to the creek, but then I was just, I just want to stay here for my meditation and so on. So I didn't do anything. And then after a day or two, I kind of got quite fascinated by these little creatures, and I realized that they're kind of cute, really. And they kind of these little wrigglies in this little water. And I was like, oh, my little water babies, it's so cute. And each day I'd come out and you can see them like growing, and they get a little bit less larvae like and a little bit more mosquito like as they go on. They get kind of darker and you can see them starting to fall. And one day I came out and there was only, they'd all gone, and there was only one mosquito like standing on the surface of the water. I was like, oh, my little baby. I say, here, come to daddy. Come to daddy. You want something to eat? You want some food? Come on. And then he takes off and flies off. I'm like, oh, sorry, sorry, sorry. So anyway, back to quarrel at Kosa Beach. So anyway, they're arguing about this silly thing. And if you've ever met human beings, you will know how realistic this is, right? If you've ever lived with people in a house or something like that, you will know that people actually do in fact argue about this ridiculous crap all the time. So they're bloody arguing on and on, you this, dividing into camps, everything like that, wounding each other with the daggers of the tongue. Yeah. And the Buddha comes along and says, okay, enough. Settle it. Stop. And then they're all like, okay, Buddha, why don't you just stay here and do some nice meditation? We'll be responsible for this quarreling. Can you imagine? Can you imagine? The Buddha's there and you're just like, oh, yeah. Anyway, okay, fine. Okay, where was I? Right, relationship between the mind and the actions. Okay, so let's say we're having a quarrel with somebody. Fine. Now then we've developed our meditation, right? We've done a bunch of retreats. We think, okay, we can go away and sit in meditation and then find some peace in meditation, because we've developed that particular line of development. We've developed to a certain degree, right? Now, actually, of course, if your sila is not good, your ethics is not good, and your mind is not in a good state, that's going to tend to undermine your meditation. But at the same time, if you've developed those skills in meditation, you can actually learn to set them aside for a while, compartmentalize, and have nice, reasonably nice meditation. I'm not saying it doesn't affect you, but you can still have reasonably nice meditation. Ah, what happens then? Then that depends on your wisdom. Remember, sila, samadhi, panya, your wisdom. Your ethics in that case is bad because you're arguing. Your meditation is reasonably okay. Oh, that's nice. I had a nice meditation. What does your wisdom tell you? Yeah? So in that case, maybe your wisdom tells you, in this meditation, I had a nice clear state of mind. I could feel that feeling of metta, and I realized how harmful my behavior had been, and that I had to reconcile with that person. I had to ask forgiveness, and I had to settle this. Right? That would be the voice of wisdom speaking to you. But maybe the voice of wisdom says to you, you know what? You know, you did that thing, but you had good meditation. That proves that you were right. You must have been right, because otherwise you couldn't have had that good meditation. Right? Right? And therefore, you should continue to do those things because you were in the right all along. And so you see how that goes? So it depends on how you reflect about it. Now, it might not be explicit like that. Right? It might be implicit. But whenever you have any kind of feeling of like peace or anything in your meditation, the ego is going to step in, right? Especially if you think that your ego is not stepping in. If you know that your ego is involved, which it is unless you're enlightened, then it's usually okay, because you can just reflect on it. You say, oh, okay, my ego is involved. It's usually okay. But if you're telling yourself, oh, no, this isn't my ego. This is like the genuine experience in meditation. I really must be letting go. I really must be advanced in my practice, because I was able to be in that situation where somebody else was making me do these bad things and I still had good meditation anyway. right? So you can see how this can actually, when you have that, think back to that idea of Ken Wilber, like the different lines of development. So if that one line of development is overdeveloped, which comes from like an overemphasis on a specific aspect of spiritual practice, then that can actually increase the disintegration from other parts of your life. And this can even be professionalized. Okay, so in the Buddhism and psychotherapy course that I teach, I had one interesting conversation with one of the students from a few courses ago, and his job was to teach corporate mindfulness. All right, so he was basically teaching managers how to be mindful, right? And we kind of talked about it and so on. He said, like, actually, you know what, most of his job is that he'll be hired by the companies to work with particular managers. Usually they're like in their 40s and they're having crises of conscience and existential crises. The company really has been making a lot of money out of this person, right? Usually it's like high functioning executive types. And then he sort of works with them to try to get them put them back together. But what he's realized is that a lot of the times what's actually happened is that they're starting to develop a conscience. And they've come out of university or whatever, and they've gone into their career, and they're like, I'm going to make it. I'm going to make some money. I'm going to do this. And when somebody has said to them, well, we need to sack 30 people, he'd be like, fine, we'll sack 30 people. And he just sacks them, and he doesn't think twice about it. And then it goes on a bit longer. And now he's reached this point where he's like, oh, you know, maybe he's had a family, maybe he's had some more life experiences or whatever. And now it's like, oh, you have to sack 30 people. But they've all got families and they've all got lives and mortgages and they're human beings. And I don't want to sack 30 people or whatever the other thing that the company wants them to do. So they can't actually fulfill that kind of ruthless killer role that they have been so profitable in doing beforehand. And so he's kind of finding that his job is to sort of, in a way, right, this is the dilemma that he was talking to me about, that he was quite tormented in his what he's doing, because on the one hand he's just helping people to learn some mindfulness and stuff, but in a way he's almost like reinforcing that disintegration where people can have a degree of mindfulness and peace and what you might pass as emotional and psychological health, while at the same time being divorced from the actual good conduct. Yeah. And there are other areas where that applies as well. For example, applying mindfulness in the military, right? Another kind of example. I mean, we do like military chaplaincy and so on, where we try to look after the emotional well-being of service people. And I think that's a good thing to do. But at the same time, if you're like training soldiers in mindfulness practice so that they can shoot and kill better, then there's a kind of a conflict there, yeah? And so there's all these different ways that you can disintegrate the behavior from the psychology. And so I've mentioned a couple of ways that could happen, but it could happen in many different other ways. So here it comes back to that main point, is that so you have to like actively integrate them, right? You have to actively keep on bringing them together. And that requires integrity. It requires patience. It requires self-reflection. And let's just again come back to that example that I gave before, like the monks in Kosambi. If I'm arguing with them, blah, 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 I'm right, they're wrong, and so on and so forth. And the Buddha's teaching about metta, which he was in that discourse, is teaching about metta. Actually, it's a fantastic story, this quarrel in Kosambi. It's in Kandaka chapter 10. Maybe somebody can pop the URL in there, because actually got some really lovely teachings and stories in there, apart from this quarrel. And so once you get stuck in that mindset, then there has to come a point where you have to realize, no, I have to change. And in that story, what happened was that they kept on quarreling to the point where they told the Buddha couldn't succeed. And eventually the Buddha just got his bowl and robes and walked out. Okay? Which you got to think. I mean, imagine, right? I mean, it's one thing disappointing your father or your mother, but you imagine disappointing the Buddha to that extent. That would be pretty, kind of make you think. So the Buddha wanders off and then he goes and meditates in the forest and so on. And so there's a very, very nice story around that. Eventually, they came to their senses. Eventually, they realized, no, we've done many, many bad things. And so they came to the Buddha, they apologized, they asked for forgiveness. And now in Buddhism, I just want to talk a little bit about that because perhaps not something that we discuss enough. So in kind of English idiom, like normal English idiom, we usually say, if we think we've done something wrong, thanks, Venerable Dhammakipa, for putting that in there. It's Brahmali's translation of the Khandaka number 10. What is it called? The Kosambi Watu or something. In English, we usually say, if we've done something wrong, we usually say sorry, right? And in fact, we'd say it so often that we'd usually say it even if we haven't done anything wrong. So whenever anyone says something sorry to me, if they haven't actually done anything wrong, then I always say, don't be sorry, be happy. Except I was defeated by the English. They just said sorry so often I couldn't keep up. But normally, we sort of say this, from a Buddhist point of view, saying sorry is not like an particularly emotionally healthy thing to do. Like you're saying, oh, I have a bad feeling because of what I did. It's like, okay, but that's your feeling. Frankly, who cares? I mean, if you've done something wrong and you feel bad about it, you should feel bad about it, actually. That means that the world is right. If you've done something bad and you don't feel bad about it, then that's a problem. Feeling bad about doing things wrong is what we call remorse, and that is an essential part of learning to do things right. Right? That's the pain, that's the moral remorse, is the moral pain that you incur when you make bad choices. You know, if you put your hand on a hot plate, you feel the pain. That's why pain exists, to tell you that you're in danger. And remorse exists in order to tell you that you have done something wrong, so that you can learn and you can change from it. So if you've done something wrong and you feel bad about it, good. You should feel bad about it. Excellent. Everything is working as normal as it should be. So from a Buddhist point of view, instead of saying sorry, what we do is we ask for forgiveness. And so you have to find the person. First of all, there's a number of specifics about this. And again, because we're not doing like hand waving around our feelings, because feelings are very changeable. But it's about behavior. So first of all, you have to go to the person who you have wronged and you have to say to them, this is what I did wrong. And you have to be specific. So in the Sangha, we do this as part of our regular confession to each other each fortnight. And in the Sangha, you have to name what class of offense that you've committed and what was the exact nature of that offense. You have to be specific about the time and the place and the details and all of these kinds of things. You can't just say, oh, I did something wrong. You have to say, you know, at that Tuesday, then I was eating the meal and it was so delicious I couldn't stop eating at 12 o'clock, so I kept on eating after the meal. And if possible, you should like mention how many mouthfuls that you swallowed, because each mouthful is a new offense. Anyway, whatever details you can, right? So you're supposed to be, you have to be specific. That's not a very good example because it's not offending against anyone, but you get the idea. So if you've offended against somebody, you don't just say, oh, look, I'm really sorry. You say, look, I said this to you and that was wrong of me to say that. And I said this and this was wrong of me to say that, yeah? And you confess the actual acts that you say. Now, the next point is also very important. When somebody came up to see the Buddha and they did this, it happens a number of times in the suttas, what does the Buddha do? Does the Buddha say, never mind? Does the Buddha say, that's okay? Does the Buddha say, don't worry, you didn't do anything wrong? No, the Buddha doesn't say any of those things. The Buddha said, yes, you are right. what you did was wrong. It was unwholesome. It was unskillful. It was something that you shouldn't have done. That this is really important to bear in mind when somebody tells you that they've done something wrong. You have to validate the fact that their remorse is genuine and that they actually understand that they've done something wrong. This is really important. If you say, oh, never mind, oh, it doesn't matter, you're not actually hearing them. It's taken them guts and courage to come to you and to say this, and you need to hear what they're saying. Oh, yeah, that was really hurtful when you said that to me. That was really hurtful. Yeah, not in an aggressive or attacking way, but you say that was really hurtful. Then the next thing you say is, and then the next thing the Buddha would say, but to acknowledge what you've done as being wrong and to make an effort to do better is growth in the Noble One's discipline, not growth in the practice of Dhamma. So you have to then acknowledge that they are taking that positive step. And again, in the Sangha, we would do this when we do our confession, and the monastic who we confess to will always say, Sangvarisami, and you say, yes, Ayating Sangvarisami, I will restrain myself in future. So you make, it's again, it's not about punishment and it's not about guilt. It's about making a resolve inside yourself that you will do better in the future. Yeah. So this is what I'm meaning when I'm talking about that practice of the integration of these different parts. It's something which is done consciously and explicitly. So if you're doing your meditation, you feel a sense of remorse for something that you've done, then don't like dwell on it or get caught up in it, but take a note of it. And when your meditation's over, then ask yourself, is there any way that I can ask forgiveness or that I can remediate that wrong that I've done in some way? I mean, sometimes we can't do it, right? Sometimes maybe it's many years later or something. But ask yourself, is there some way that I can do that? And then you bring that back into it. At the very least, you ask yourself, how do I avoid making that same problem in the future? And again, you can reflect on specific things. Oh, yeah, you know why I got so angry with that person? Because, you know, I hadn't slept much that night and, you know, and so on and so on. Just remember, next time you're in that situation, be more mindful, be more careful. And so you deliberately bring those lessons from one space into the other. So this is what I mean by integrating things. Yeah, so if you bump into a person shopping, saying sorry is expressed in Australian culture. Now, in that case, I think it's okay. I think if you bump into someone, you say sorry, oh, that's all right, because you've actually done something, right? A lot of people say sorry when they haven't actually done anything. But anyway, whatever, I don't want to sort of dwell on that too much. When I was in London, they told me that there'd been a game show where they tried to go around London collecting sorries. Like you won the game show by having the maximum number of people saying sorry to you in the day. So one person just stood at the bottom of the stairs in the central train station and like thousands of people walk past them and just every single one of them says sorry as they go past. So they so they won the game. Anyway. That's that. Yes, integration. So there's the specific development of the different parts of the spiritual path, sila, samadhi, panya, good conduct, meditation, and wisdom. All of those are independent practices. We develop those practices, but we also reflect on them and try to bring the integration. And it's wisdom which ultimately lets us to do that, because wisdom is the one that sees the relationship between these different parts and wants us to bring that integration between them. So one of the really amazing things about Buddhism, okay, is that when you start to do this and you start to reflect on it, you begin to see all the ways that the Buddha's teachings are in fact integrated. I talked a little bit about that before, about, say, the precepts, like to not kill, and then the Buddha said, let go of hate. Actually, that's an integration between the psychological dimension and the behavioral dimension. That's a fairly straightforward one. But there are so many other cases where you see, oh, yeah, this bit of the Dhamma actually connects with that bit of the Dhamma, and that bit of the Dhamma connects with this bit of the Dhamma. And you start to see that the Dhamma itself is highly integrative, and that mirrors the process of integration that we take in our own mind and in our conduct and our behavior. And this is one of the reasons, in fact, why a lot of the Dhamma teachings are expressed in terms of numbers. And especially you see this in like the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta and so on, where you have like the Four Noble Truths and then the Eightfold Noble Path and then the 12 of this and the 16 of that. And these are all kind of like a mandala where everything is like fitting together and everything is part of everything else. So all of the parts of the Dhamma all fit together like a kind of Lego puzzle or something like that. So this is the that's how that works. So I just want to reply briefly to a message. Okay, so so that's my talk for this evening on integration of the different aspects of the Dhamma path. Any questions or thoughts about that? Adrian, yeah.
You mentioned the Khandaka number 10 book. So does that, because I'm not really familiar with the Vinaya book. So does that mention other things other than what's mentioned in the sutta?
It does, in fact, yeah.
Okay, cool.
So there's a few places in the Vinaya where you have longer narratives that are some places are scattered throughout the suttas.
Right.
This is one of those cases. So some of the things found there is unique to the Vinaya. Other things are shared with the suttas. So it's actually quite intertextual. For example, like the verses, hatred is never overcome by hate, it's only overcome by love. That's found in that context. We find it in the narrative. But in the Dhammapada, it's just the verse.
Right.
So there's cases like that where there are things shared, but there's also quite a lot of unique content in that particular one. Yeah. In fact, there's a really good story there, the story of Dighayu, and how he overcame conflict and so on. It's kind of like a Jataka style story, and that's in there as well. And that's quite unique in the it's a kind of unique use of storytelling in the context of the Vinaya in that case. Yeah. Yep. Okay. Any other questions? Eka.
With the three components like sila, samadhi, and panya.
Yeah.
You mentioned the panya, the panya is the wisdom.
Yeah.
If the wisdom is in not the right wisdom, what's the best way to bring it to the right wisdom?
Okay. So Eka's asking if the wisdom is not the right wisdom, because I talked about that, right? So you can have like this pseudo-wisdom, then how do you bring it to the right wisdom? Well, I mean, that's, of course, delusion, right? So delusion is the wrong wisdom, right? Yeah. Delusion is the way that the mind hides its nature from itself. And delusion is wisdom and delusion is different from intelligence, okay? So very intelligent people can be very delusional, yeah? And you can use your intelligence to delude yourself, yeah? I don't know if anybody's been keeping track of all of the scientists and academics who are in the Epstein files. For those of us who've been reading Noam Chomsky when we were younger, and that's very disappointing, and bunches of others. People can be very intelligent, and then, you know, their egos can be flattered and all of those things. So there's a difference between intelligence and wisdom, and intelligence can be used to hide the truth. Yeah. So again, there's no real secret to that, but there are a few basic things that we can do. First thing we can do is we can ask how well that fits in with what the Buddha taught, right? So the Buddha said, you know, you can reflect on what is said by the wise. That's one thing. Second thing you can do is to focus on specifics, all right? This is actually really useful. if you've been in any, if you've worked in any kind of professional, like especially in a research capacity or any kind of professional capacity or something like that, you will know that one of the things you sort of see is that people in that profession tend to, you tend to like deal with a lot of detailed, specific things all the time. But people's opinions about that profession tend to be very broad and wishy-washy. I don't know if you kind of noticed that. But anyway, so wisdom will be able to see details. Like wisdom's not going to get caught up on details. That's a different thing, right? But wisdom can see details. So you can ask yourself some detailed and specific questions, yeah? So rather than having like a feeling about like what I did and so on, maybe you might ask yourself some specific questions. Like when you said the words this and this to that person, what were you feeling at that time? Yeah? Rather than more sort of generalizations about, oh, I was in the right all along and so on and so forth, yeah? At that moment, what was your heart telling you? And so because you can come back to specifics, then that's going to help your real wisdom to arise. Yeah. So that's just a couple of ways that you can do that. Yeah.
So is Chomsky in those?
Oh, yeah, Chomsky was good mates with Epstein, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, he said, oh, Epstein was a great guy. We were really good friends. We got along well. Yeah, like it's not just his name appears once or twice. They were friends. Like I don't know whether Chomsky was, you know, going out to the island and stuff. Like it doesn't say what the nature of it, but they certainly had a relationship. Okay. I think Epstein was really good at flattering people and at like, you know, making people feel important, you know. And anyway, so it is a kind of, I've found it quite a moving like reflection on the kind of the nature of evil and the way that evil manifests in society. Like you just see that it's, you know, we just take so many things for granted, you know, and it's just the exposure of I guess a side of humanity that we would really rather not have to acknowledge. Anyway. Okay. All right. So we should probably wrap up around now. I want to thank you all for coming, especially those folks here in Parramatta on a somewhat muggy night here, and all of those wonderful people online. Nicola, good to see you. Haven't seen you in a while. How's things?
Good. I've been traveling.
It's a reaction sound. Sorry about that, Nicola. I missed you got cut off. Anyway, okay. Anyway, good to see you back. Hopefully, we'll see you around Sydney in the next little while. If you're around, let me know. And all of our wonderful friends, Venerable Dhamma Kippa, Gita, Justin, Martina, Mike, Sumana, Terry. Terry's looking different today. How's it going? And all of our wonderful friends. And so just to repeat, as I said at the beginning, in case anyone new has joined us online, we just found out immediately before this talk that this center is actually closing down tomorrow. So we're not going to be able to run the following week's talks, according to the calendar. I will have to change the calendar. So this will be the last Friday night talk for this year. We will begin the Friday night talks mid-January. Most likely, the Friday night talks will be done from Crow's Nest, which will not affect those people online at all. But for Sydney folks, Crow's Nest Centre on the Friday, and probably at the 5, aka P-Hive, the Parramatta Library, probably on a Tuesday, and that'll be starting mid-January. And just for the record, we do have, I think, one or two more talks at Crow's Nest on Wednesday nights. I think we have two more at Crow's Nest. So, Crow's Nest is on next week. I think it's on for the next 2 weeks, Nicola. So then we'll be having a break over Christmas, New Year, and the start again mid-January. Also, just I've mentioned this before, but we are not having a retreat, Christmas retreat this year, as we usually do, because we couldn't book the venue. but it looks like we're going to be having a retreat at Broken Hill or outside Broken Hill next year in the autumn sometime, probably April, May, and we will let you know all of the details of that. So that is going to be awesome. For those of you living in Sydney or regions thereabouts, you can catch a train out to Broken Hill and or drive out if you'd rather. And we'll be arranging like a shuttle from the train station to the venue and so on. If you're in Adelaide or know someone in Adelaide, it's actually even closer. It's actually only a few hours drive from Adelaide. So and also it's basically just as far from Melbourne, actually, by the time you get out there, and from Brisbane so much further as well. Anyway, so that's where we're going to really looking forward to that. And it's a really great opportunity to have a meditation out in the desert, but a little bit more accessible than doing in Uluru, which we did last time, which is quite expensive to get out there. Okay. So, and we, and I'm just, you know, that's not necessarily the only retreat that we'll be doing. It's the one that we have planned at the moment, but we will let you know if we're doing others as they come up. Thank you so much, everybody. May you be happy. See you next year. Or beforehand.